communism, and also toward a kind of attempt to experiment with utopian.
Imagine yourself, well, first of all, the question about tonight is brotherhood. What is brotherhood? Imagine yourself, well, first of all, the question about tonight is brotherhood. What is brotherhood? Imagine yourself, well, first of all, the question about tonight is brotherhood. What is brotherhood? We're moving on. Well, first of all, the question about tonight is brotherhood. What is brotherhood? If I say, I am your brother, what is it, brotherhood? What is brotherhood? You are my brother. How does that affect you if someone were to come up to you and say, brother, give me a book, or something, or just say, brother, some stranger like myself, say, were to come up to you and say that? How would you react? In a church situation, I guess you might say, well, it's good to have brotherhood, but now some of them, I don't really like them, you know, and I'd never be brothers with them. And the old question is even in the Bible where they have something like, am I my brother's keeper? Imagine yourself in a subway tunnel. For those who haven't been in cities like Montreal, New York, Boston, Chicago, and that, the tunnel is about as high as the balcony ladders, the balcony things up here. And it's kind of a curve, and it's got tracks on one side. They split them up in most cities, and some they have a common too. Well, this is where the story takes place. And our main hero, the person who is writing this story in his own words, is called Equality, 7/25/21. We don't know what time of year it is, what year it is at all, but it is sometime in the future, possibly thousands of years beyond this day. To begin, it is a sin to write this. It explains why. We all know that there is no transgression blacker than to do or to think alone. He's in a community, which he doesn't name, which their ideas are that which is done alone or that which is done by yourself is evil, but that which is done for all the good, the common good, is good and is to be promoted. And he describes his life to us. He doesn't know his parents because there is a house of mating, a house of controlled mating headed by the Council of Eugenics, where at the age of 18, girls are sent there, and at the age of 20, boys or men are sent there to mate, and they are chosen by their gene characteristics to produce the best boys or girls, however they may be, for the society. So he is born nonetheless, and he is put into the home of infants for his first 5 years. And he finds that he has already committed a transgression against his brothers. In this house of infants, those that are born in that year are all put together, and he's in a dormitory of 100 beds of all boys. And his first transgression is that he's fighting with them, as young boys do, between each other. And so for his punishment, they put him in the cellar several days, and he found that he couldn't resist this rebellion that he had in him. And then at 5, he's sent to the home of the students. This is where he stays for 10 years, and there are divisions for each year for various stages of learning. And then at 15, where we're, he made a good point on that, he has to be chosen for a vocation by the Council of Vocation, and they call it a life mandate. Sounds like in the future, when he becomes 15, in the spring, the council comes around, says you are to be this or you are to be that. I'm going to give a little quote from there just to give you an idea of how the Ayn Rand describes it. At 15, he is reciting to his teachers, we are nothing, mankind is all. By the grace of our brothers, we are about our lives. We exist through, by, and for our brothers who are escaped. Amen. That's his pledge of allegiance. And the mandates, the Council of Vacations came on the first day of spring. They sat in a great hall. And we who were 15 and all the teachers came in the great hall. And the Council of Vacations sat on a high bed. and they have the two words to speak to each of the students. They call the students' names, and when the students step before them, one after another, the council said carpenter, doctor, cook, lawyer, leader. Then each student raised his right arm and said, "The will of our brothers be done." Now, if the council said carpenter or cook, the students would go assigned to the work that they had and not study any further. But if he said leader, the students would go to the House of Leaders, which is the greatest house in the city, for it has three stories. Then he proposed further to describe the House of Scholars. There are divisions for the scholars, and they are certified by the teachers and the council, of course. And he is a bright student. He finds that he has another transgression when he's in school, that he has the habit of exploring and the habit of wondering. He says, "We were born with a curse. It has always driven us to thoughts which are forbidden. It has always given us wishes which men may not wish. We know that we are evil. There is no will in us and no power to resist it. This is our wonder, our secret fear that we know and do not resist." It's a wonder. Now, these two quotes that I've read you so far, you notice that I didn't say "I" in it. He has learned to speak using just "we," representing himself. And if he says something to you, he says "you," or "theirs," or "them." He never uses a singular form of it, and he never uses the word "I." And this is the unmentionable word that they are brought up never to speak. When he's 11 or so, he finds the first martyr that he sees in his life is a young man, about 22, blonde hair and rather tall, who is taken to the village square, and his tongue is torn out. And he doesn't even know the word "sing" until that point. When this person is taken to the square, and all the people are yelling at him and mocking him, because he mentions one word, "I," he had discovered in a manuscript from our times, or possibly written somewhere in secret. And this young man with blonde hair looks at our character, Equality 7, so forth. And Equality kind of cringes when he sees this, and he feels that he's got to find out why this person is a saint. So he has kind of a religious experience, or kind of a communication with one of the saints of their time. So, as it happens, when he's 15, he's chosen to be, of all things, a street cleaner. And that is his occupation until he was 40. So it's 25 years of being a street cleaner. And he is taken right away to the home of the street sweepers. And there he meets his companions, the other persons, International 4, 88, 18, and Union 5, 39, 92, who is a half-wit. And as I mentioned earlier, the way they tell each other apart, there's no other way, of course, except seeing each other, but there is on each one's wrist a metal wristband, permanently attached, something like the hospital have these plastic bands, this is the middle, with just the name Equality 7, 25, 21. So his work is kind of set up this way as a street cleaner. In the morning he goes out to work when the sun is coming up for 5 hours. Then he has a half-hour lunch, and then in the afternoon he has 5 hours again of work, and then 1 hour for dinner. So when he comes back, his evenings are kind of set up this way, as they are for most people of all the trades, in fact. He has a social meeting where he meets with all his brothers, and the leaders of various cities and various areas who are visiting come and give speeches. And his speeches are generally on themes of mankind, unity, development, and so forth. And then at the end he sings his hymns, the hymns of brotherhood, the hymn of equality, and the hymn of collective spirit. Afterwards, he has 3 hours of social recreation at the city theater, in which the home of the actors split up into two choruses, each one representing one voice. And their plays are various each night, but the plays, he says, are about toil and how good it is. So he's got pretty much of a bleak night. But the thing is that our character doesn't question that as much because he is very amazing. One time our subway tunnel takes place 6 years after he's been established as a street sweeper. And he discovers this tunnel as he's pushing the streets through and goes to behind the theater, finds this hole, goes down and finds this tunnel. It's about a half mile long, and the two ends are caved in. And he finds inside it, he finds something that looks like stone, but it's smooth. They haven't invented cement yet. And he finds something on the bottom, two rails, that is smooth as glass, but it feels like iron. So they haven't invented steel yet. And he brings down his candle, and he also discovers that there are bolts of glass on the sides of this tunnel here. But he doesn't know what to do with them, and he doesn't know what to do with the copper wires. They are in the candlelights. It took them 100 years to establish the candle as a form of light. They had previously used torches. So it is here that he steals manuscripts from the House of Scholars. Now the manuscripts are also similarly undeveloped. It takes 1 year, usually on average, for one of the House of Clerks to copy a manuscript from another town and put it in the scholar's library. And so he steals many of them and reads them down in the subway tunnel. There again is another transgression that he hit us. So this goes on for 2 years. He's reading these manuscripts, and he finds he isn't getting anywhere because they never acknowledge much technology. They still are trying to perfect the horse and the cart by adding additions to the wheels and things like this. And he finds that he's looking for something, and something to use, or something more powerful and meaningful. And while he's going on along the streets one day, he discovers in the fields a girl working, and her hair is gold, very golden long, and it kind of blows in the wind. So she stands out from the rest of the girls who have short hair, and it kind of strikes against her white tunic. Everyone in this town wears tunics and togas, and they're white. And so he calls her the golden one, and she's rather tall with this white hood. And he looks at her every day for a long time, several months, and he thinks that she's looking, but he doesn't know. So the first time, he formulates a signal so his brothers won't know that he is saying something to her, because to talk to the women is against the brotherhood edicts, or against the laws of the patients. So he makes a kind of a salute to her that it looks like he's shaving himself in the sunlight. Well, I'll kind of shorten it here. She's called Liberty 53000. She's 17 years old. Now at 18, she's to be taken in the House of Meeting. And there, the Council of Eugenics decides who shall mate with her, and she doesn't see her children either. This is the future that 9-1 is portraying so far. And she says, or the author here says in the town, that various people have discovered things, but that the council has taken away their inventions and rendered them useless. They are not allowed to discover or to mention anything which is not of the common spirit. Consequently, no one speaks because they are afraid that they might not be saying what others agree on. So life goes this way. They have candles and torches, and they have horses and carts. And he discovers in one of the manuscripts that there was a great war, a script fire, in which a mass of good people fought against the very minority of evil ones. They're called the evil ones. And they ruined their books and destroyed their words as well. And this was about 1,000 years ago, according to this. So it appears that Ayn Rand implies that the masses had overwon. She wrote this in 37, so she can use the term masses quite well. Maybe we would say the majority today. That's all he knows of his life there. And when he discovers this girl, he feels something new in himself. As you can guess, if you stay with all men in a dormitory, or if all women stay together, there's nothing like love. So when he first discovers her, he comes home singing, and his home of the streetlings, one of the council members reprimands him and says, "Are you singing? You shouldn't be doing this." And he says, "We are singing because we are happy."
We answered to one of the home council who reprimanded us. Indeed, you are happy, they answered. How else can men be when they look for their brothers? And now, sitting here in our tunnel, we wonder about these words. It is forbidden not to be happy, for, as it has been explained to us, men are free, and the earth belongs to them, and all things on earth belong to all men, and the will of all men together is good for all, and so all men must be happy. He discovers another thing. He looks at the bodies of the men as they dress in the kennel at night. The eyes of our brothers are dull, and never do they look at one another in the eyes. The shoulders of our brothers are hunched, and their muscles are drawn, as if their bodies were shrinking and wished to shrink out of sight. And a word steals into our mind as we look upon our brothers, and then we disappear. So he has discovered by himself that between men, when men are gathered in such a group like this, that despite the brotherhood, there is this element of fear between man and man. It's kind of a competitive fear. I don't know if Ron would agree with me, but it stems back, I think, to our behavior when we were kind of like animals, more of animals rather than creatures. There is fear hanging in the air of the sleeping halls and in the air of the streets. Fear walks through the city, fear without name, without shape. All men feel it and not in the air to speak. So the story goes on that he communicates this way to the golden man with the salute every day, and he's becoming more and more, and he wants to run away with her. And in this city, they have kind of a holding situation in which you are surrounded by an uncharted forest. They call it the uncharted forest, and they say that the trees and the wild beasts help to eat up the evil ones in their civilization. So the trees covered up the older cities and just grew and grew, and they just have areas like here. And you are not permitted to go into the uncharted forest because you will be eaten up by the wild beasts and so forth. And he's thinking kind of running away with her. And but since they don't communicate to each other, of course he can't get on the way. He discovers one time when he's got his stick picking up papers, like you do in the parks, that he hits a frog. And apparently the frog's leg moves, and if it was a dead frog, he discovers electricity this way. I guess his stick he had on the tip a bit of zinc or something, and there was a copper wire that the frog was on. And when he tapped the two with the frog between it, the electricity generated in this situation here, this cell, made the frog's leg kind of back up like that. So he employs this idea, he brings copper plates and zinc plates into his tunnel. And he gets them grimed, and he makes the first dry cell that his town or anyone has ever heard of in age. And then his next invention is to discover the light bulb, or to discover the light. He gets a filament between the two points of the zinc and the copper ends of the dry cell, like a battery. And he notices that it glows and it makes light. And thus, he's discovered something, an invention, and he becomes real enthused. Now, as it happens, every year the Council of Scholars comes around to examine the scholars and to examine what has been developed in each area, what the scholars, what inventions, to review them. And so he figures if he can bring this invention of light, the light bulb, to them, that they will automatically elect him as a scholar for his invention because it serves all mankind. And they will forgive him for sneaking away from his brothers and hiding in a tunnel, and even writing this book, as it happens, writing this manuscript. About 10 days before this happens, he comes back late, and his other brothers notice that he's late, and they say, "Where were you?" And he says, "I won't tell you." So he is sent to the house of detention, and there they whip him continuously for a long time, just to find out where he went, because they're afraid that he might have thought unthinkable things, or he might have done things which are not for the good of mankind and so forth. He's very uptight about this. But he doesn't give the answer. Now, the house of detention is a place that has no guards in it, and it also, the locks are rather old, and it's not maintained well. because everyone assumes that that all the people in this town will obey whatever command they are given by the council. So if the council says go to the street sweepers, you are a street sweeper for the rest of your life, or a carpenter, or a doctor, or something. You do this. You don't disagree. And also, if you are a criminal, they say go to the house of detention, and you go there, and you don't disagree. So there's no need to really guard the place at all. It's like a normal house, really. So he escapes, and he gets his light bulb, or he gets his light working again. And he runs out into the streets the next morning, and he runs to the council of scholars that are meeting right there in the home of the scholars. He figures if he can present this life to them, that he will be elected as a scholar, and he will thus get his life's work that he really wants. When he comes in, they say, "Who are you?" And he says, "Well, I'm Equality 7-25-21. And they say, "Well, you don't look like a scholar. You've got this white tunic on and you're very dirty and stuff." He says, "I know." He says, "I'm a street cleaner." And suddenly they're very uptight about this. They say, "How dare you enter into the scholars' home? Street sweepers and people of other trades are not allowed to enter. This is also one of their laws." But he says, "Anyway, our brothers, we men are not our transgression. Give no thought to us, we are nothing," and so forth. "Listen to us, for we hold the future of mankind in our hands." And they listen. And he says, we placed our glass box upon the table before them. And then he begins to operate this. But terror struck the men of the council. They leapt to their feet, and they ran from the table, and they stood pressed against the wall, huddled together, seeking the warmth of one another's bodies, giving courage. So they looked at them and laughed, and said, "Fear nothing, our brothers. There is a great power in these wires that are lighting before you. But this power is tamed. It is yours. We give it to you. We give you the power of the sky." But they don't agree. The head scholar, collective 00009, says, "We have much to say to you. We have much to say to a bunch who has broken all the walls and boast of their infamy. How dare you think that your mind held greater wisdom than the mind of your brothers? And if the councils have decreed that you should be a street sweeper, how dare you think that you could be a greater use to men than sweeping the streets?" And so forth. Now this is, "How dare you, you gutter cleaner, how dare you even come in here with this?" And now this is, "You should be burned at the stake," and this is lashed. And they go on like this, and they say, we really can't use your invention, because it took us 50 years to convince all the world councils and to convince all mankind to use candles. They never could agree for this for 50 years, and this also involved a lot of production. We had to take people off from producing torches and reassemble their units so they can make candles. So he says, "And we just did this. We just did this 100 years ago, so we don't want to upset things again with this light bulb of yours." So they say, in effect, they say, "Get out of here now." So he breaks out and he runs very wildly through the streets with his box and runs into an uncharted forest. And there, his first day, he is kind of running and walking, and he's afraid that he might get eaten by the beast. But then he's also curious, because he's never seen a forest, a very dense forest of trees and so forth. And he finds that the moss is quite comfortable to sleep on at night, and he kills his first bird with a stone. And he builds a fire, and he finds that living like this is quite good. You know, he's kind of a modern hippie in their time, so I suppose Ayn Rand is saying it is possible that hippies, even in this future, if it ever comes about. So he walks again. The second day, he comes to a pool of clear water, and he sees his reflection. Now, in his community, they've never had mirrors, because they thought it was evil for a person to look at themselves. They thought that no one should see themselves or think of themselves as well, the betterment of mankind and so forth. And he's just amazed. He says, "Wow." He says, "I really look good, you know." And previously, he had been pretty gloomy about things. He thought he looked like his other brothers, which are kind of scraggly, and just looked like they were dead. But, so he's amazed at this. He finds that he has been followed by the Golden One. She broke away when she heard the news, and she followed his footsteps. So they both wander through the forest, and they discover this house, a kind of a house of two stories, like one of the chalets here, with glass windows, and he's amazed to see glass windows. And he's amazed when he goes in the house. He says, no, this house doesn't look like it could sleep more than 12 people in it. And then he walks up to the bedroom, and he finds out there's only two beds. And he's even more amazed. He says, wow, there's only two people sleeping here instead of our usual 100. And so he discovers all the things, the walls of glass that are on the ceiling, you know, along the sides of the house, and he finds things like plates made out of china and silverware. And he finds manuscripts, his books. He finds books that are even different than his own manuscripts. Previously, they had scrolls that the clerks copied 1 year at a time, and they were, you know, in good handwriting and so forth. But he found that the print of books was very small and very different from the manuscripts he was reading. And when he is going through these books, he discovers the unmentionable word, and that's I. Previously, he always said, we shall go, or we would like to do this, meaning himself, because that was the way he was taught to think. Now, Ayn Rand inserts, to me, it's really just her philosophy in here. It's not very continuous with the novel. It's kind of like a cogito ergo sum of Descartes. She begins, I am, I think, I will. My hands, my spirit, my soul, my forest, this earth of mine. What must I say besides? These are the words, this is the answer. And it goes on in that spirit. It is my eyes which see, and the sight of my eyes grants beauty to the earth. And my ears which hear, the hearing of my ears gives its song to the world. And my mind which thinks, and so forth. Many words have been granted to me, and some are wise and some are false, but only three are holy. I will it. And it goes in this vein. I am neither foe nor friend to my brothers, but such as each of them shall deserve me. And to earn my love, my brothers must do more than have been born. I do not grant my love without reason, nor to any chance passerby who may wish to claim it. I honor men with my love, but honor is a thing to be earned. I shall choose my friends among men, but neither slaves nor masters. And I shall choose only such as please me, and them shall I love and respect, but neither command nor obey. Let each man keep his temple untouched and undefiled, and let him join hands with others if he wishes, but only beyond his holy threshold. For the word we must never be spoken, save by one's choice and at the second thought. This word must never be placed within man's soul, else it becomes a monster, the root of all evils on earth, the root of man's torture by men, and of an unspeakable life. What is my joy if all hands, even the unclean, can reach into it? What is my wisdom if even the fools can dictate to me? What is my freedom if all creatures, even the botched and impotent, are my masters? What is my life if I am but to bow, to agree, and to obey? And now I see the face of God, and I raise this God over the earth, this God whom men have sought since men came into being, this God who will grant them joy and peace and pride, this God, this one word, I. That's Ayn Rand right there. She gives kind of a, it goes on, and they live in the house, and they find that they can live quite easily by tilling the fields and killing animals and birds and so forth. And he gets so developed that he feels that he might go back to the city and bring some of his other brothers and his sisters into this uncharted forest and show them that they can live quite freely by themselves. And he also, after he's read a lot, he's found the history of the unmentionable times, our history. At first, man was enslaved by the gods, but he broke their chains. Then he was enslaved by the kings, but he broke their chains. Then he was enslaved by his birth, by his king, by his race, but he broke their chains. Now notice this goes up to your 1776 right here. He declared to all his brothers that a man has rights which neither God nor king nor other men can take away from him, no matter what their number. For his is the right of man, and there is no right on earth above this right. And he stood on the threshold of freedom from which the blood of the centuries behind him had been spilled. That's his book. That's Ayn Rand's book right there. It's, as I say, it's short, it's brief. It's kind of a setup for her philosophical position. Now, the last quote is very good, I think, because he says that at first we were honored the gods, the time of Homer of Greece, that the gods of fate determined our life. Then he says later on it was things like kingship. Or he says it was the kings. Next was the kings. The kings ruled our lives. What the kings said we did. And we believed in the kings. And then he says it's things like kinship, race, and where you were born, status, that type of thing. Then he says, along in history comes this thing that we declare that we have rights only unto ourselves, the Declaration of Independence, or the Magna Carta, things like this, which developed in history, where man thought that he could be a master only to himself, to themselves. Then he said, we have fallen into this thing of we, or into our brotherhood. We thought that we should be mastered by the master, by the goodwill of all, by the goodness of all. And he said that's where our whole trouble began. You know, that's where the world kind of ended and their society began. And what's interesting is it kind of, the thought of Ayn Rand, which I've never gotten over fully, I've often discussed this in college myself, and every novel of hers has essentially the same idea and variations, is that this rejects God, this rejects religion, because one should not obey religion, but obey himself, according to this. This rejects government, except for the in cases of chaos or just for harmony. It rejects all sorts of things. Kings, of course. It rejects things of race or being born in certain places, the silver spoon mentality too. And what I'd kind of like to bring in here is religion moving this way? Are we going to reject God in the future and say that we are unto ourselves the best? Can this really happen? Or will it happen like Ayn Rand says, that we say that the mass of humanity, the majority wins, brotherhood, this type of thing, that we should obey others, or we should obey the general rules, the social laws, the social beings. She gives in her foreword something like this. She says, she admits that it's a bit idealistic, but she says, social gains, social aims, social objectives have become the daily bromides of our language. The necessity of a social justification for all activities in existence is now taken for granted. I shall merely point out that the slogan production for use and not for profit is now accepted by most men as a commonplace and a commonplace stating with proper desirable goal. If any intelligible meaning can be discerned in that slogan at all, what is it if not the idea that the motive of a man's work must be the need of others, not his own need, desire, or gain? I wonder if we are getting towards that direction that we feel that we are much more obliged towards our brother. Or are we going in the other direction? Or what direction are we going in this case, where we are rejecting God and we are relying more on ourselves?
Doesn't the first one reject God too?
Yeah, brotherhood would be kind of God for them too, in that case. The good of all men.
I think she's totally unrealistic. In the first place, the first community she sets up, I don't think it ever come about. I think more realistic than that would be a brave new world, which might be possible in the future, and which would be as equally undesirable, I think. But then she makes a mistake, I think, of painting this bleak picture of community where the individual is nothing, and where everything's toward the community and everybody's controlled, to the opposite extreme, where it's the complete individual and total lack of community. And says, it's just me, I'm my God. And if anybody is going to get my love, they're going to have to deserve it. Not just because they're a human being, but because they deserve it.
Well, right there, do you think that you deserve my love just because you are born, just because you're a human also? Don't you think that you should achieve something? I think we all have opinions on that. most people will say, who are you? And they mean like, what did you achieve in mankind? What did you donate to culture? Aren't they kind of that way?
Yeah, is that right? It's not Christian by any means.
No.
That theme that you're talking about, though, she develops in her other book, Atlas Shrugged. This is the whole thesis there. That I can do as I damn well please. And if you can't do me any good, then don't bother. And this is the whole thesis in her book there. Very pragmatic. And I owe you nothing. And if you can't make your way in this world, then get out of my way. Because I don't have to support you or help you in any way.
I think we're looking at the negative part too. On this. In this book is really very negative, except towards the end, where he says, I am. He says, to hell with all you creeps who say, we are, they are, the mankind is. He's saying, I am, and I shall develop myself intellectually, morally, physically, and so forth, just because I am. And so he takes his own life as well. Howard Brook in The Fountainhead is something like this character as well. And he's an architect. And the story, kind of in brief, is about half the size of Atlas Shrugged, which is also enormous. He's an architect, and he's asked to design something like our tenements or our slum dwellings that we have now in the city, these 17 and 20-story structures, which they can put all the slum dwellers into. So he designed some place that is artistically beautiful, if that's ever possible. Is also low on the economy, it doesn't cost much, and has a lot of features that get rid of the machinated look from it, gets rid of the IBM card look and appearance, and makes it quite intriguing. It has a lot of niches, halls, and corridors. It's not uniform at all. And so he delivers this design to the city, and one of the city developers says, oh, this will never do. He says, they just cut our money this year down by a quarter. He says, we'll have to take this and this out. And he rips out balconies, he straightens out the hallways, and he does all kinds of things. And so Rourke, the architect, is very incensed by this. So he and his girl, who believes in his selfishness as well, they blow up the building. It's partly constructed already. And they get dynamite, and they just blow up the bits. So he's taken to court. And this is where Ryan's idealism comes in. They say, why'd you do this? And it's a civil suit against him. And he explains his position, that man is entitled to his own art and his own development. That which he creates, no man should be allowed to alter, and so forth. And so he wins his argument in court. And he develops in this way. He develops a mile-high skyscraper. And he develops also a home for his newspaper friend, Ken Wyandotte, which is kind of like Ayn Rand thinks that she lives in, she wants to live in. It's a house in the suburbs somewhere, or out in the woods, that has barbed wire and electric wire barricades around it, keeping other people away. It's interesting to note other authors have done this kind of thing, Salinger for one. And the real positive point is that we need more Howard Rourke, I suppose, socially. I can't say need, but things might be better if there were more independent people who thought of themselves rather than others. But is this good? Can you just think of yourself? Or should you just think of yourself? I think psychologically, a person has to think of himself first before he can think of this Christianity, this sharing, this brotherhood. I don't think you can share with anybody unless you are really with yourself, unless you feel good about yourself. And that's why I don't think they should teach children Christianity when they're children. They might teach them Christian motives, but they shouldn't enforce them that they should share. You get the idea, kind of like parents, they say, naughty, naughty, that's selfish of you, Jimmy. You should share this with Susie, whatever it is. You should share, you know. And children never do this by instincts. Children are selfish, as a rule. I've taught, and I haven't found any exceptions so far to this. Children, when they get something, it's mine. Mine, that's the common word. Me want to do this. We had a child in our our migrant center, when they use we, this child was born, is born by hillbillies, and he has a habit of saying, me want to go, me want to go pot, and things like that. It was just funny that he never said I, but that was the habit, that his hillbilly parents and his brothers and sisters were so possessive, they would keep on saying me, 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 that he just adapted the word me instead of I. And maybe would it be better in society if we grew up this way, being selfish into ourselves, and developing by ourselves, educating ourselves, getting what we want, working for ourselves, and so forth, rather than be assisted by others. Of course, for children, it is practical because they can't be on their own. But we think that we're thinking in terms of adults in our welfare state, our Medicare, our Social Security things. We think that the state should be obliged to take care of people. I'd kind of like to just talk to that issue, whether it's this a good tendency or not.
Welfare, for example.
Are we really obliged, in, as a businessman, are you obliged? Paul Hayden brings up in his book, Private Keepers of the Public Interest, to do things for social goods. Are you obliged to stop the pollution in the air that your factory is making? Are you obliged to make it more comfortable for your workers? Are you really obliged to do this? Or Ayn Rand contends that your main objective in business is just to make a profit and make it the best way you can, regardless of how much it affects anyone else, regardless of how the town feels about your business. As long as you make your profit, you're satisfying your own needs.
In what you were saying about children, I think that you have to qualify between self-love and selfishness. I think it's very important for them to get a sense of loving themselves and respecting themselves and feeling that there are times when their needs have to come first. But I think also that if they have to be selfish, and I think that's a very different thing from the self-love.
I was just saying that. Could you refer to it?
Well, self-love is a devotion to yourself, in that you watch out for yourself and you watch out for what you do. Protect your rights to some extent when you're trying to build up a good opinion of yourself. But it's a lot different, I think, than selfishness, because then you're putting your, not really putting yourself first, but you're maybe taking from others.
Are you taking from others? If I have an ice cream bar, someone says, why did you share that with someone? I say, no. They said, that would be self-love, maybe. Or would that be selfish? Your turn.
I could say from Gunnar today a little example on that. Maybe he isn't free yet, but he climbs up on that stool, and his friend Mark is beside him, and he gets two bits out of his pocket and gets up and he's got about a 10-word vocabulary. Crazy. Crazy. Mark. Me. Oh, well, his self-love included sharing, and that Mark should share. I don't think they had one box of raisins. It would have been a very happy thing. They had enough money for two, you know. And then the joy of the raisins was increased. They both could go out of the box, you know.
And the concept of sin, is there such a thing as sin? Sin is what you call sin, where you are violating the natural law. Let's say the Catholics consider it the natural law, the law of Moses, the Ten Commandments, New Testament, and also there's development violating the laws of your brothers. Is this a sin? If you are driving on the wrong side of the road, is it really a sin if you get by doing this kind of thing? The argument is that for social order and social harmony, and for the respect of our law and legal institutions, we shouldn't do this. But in terms of Ayn Rand, this is perfectly all right if you can get by and survive pretty well with this. You can do it yourself. Are you obliged, if you have a parcel of land, to cut the hedges on it? Or to, like in a city, you have civil codes, which you have to build your house according to the building code. You have to keep the hedges all around the corners so drivers and motors can see as they go around the street corners and things like this. Are you really obliged to do this?
Does she think that everybody could get along like this? I mean, the thing is, how many people would live like this if they had a chance to be completely selfish? probably very few would take the initiative and the effort to do it. I mean, there are some people that are, by their nature, just completely helpless in a sense, independent to that welfare and stuff like this becomes consensual.
Well, there again, she says, why should I be ruled by the weak and the impotent? Why should I be ruled by the botched and the cripples? Why should they be up there telling me what to do? This sometimes happens, but she doesn't cite in this book or anywhere else where this really happens in legal situations.
From your part of view there, Han, though, now, when she uses terms like this, how do you feel about them? I mean, aren't the crippled and the maimed and so on often those with the greatest imagination and the most interest? For all these aggressive, egocentric people she's talking about are dull as all get out. They wouldn't understand a poem of yours, nor would they buy one.
Well, let me ask this. Does any man have the power to rule over me?
It seems to me that more than demanding a person to be completely selfish, she's demanding a perfect freedom of choice. You know, she's not necessarily demanding that you be selfish, but she's asking that a person has the right to be, you know, to have an absolute freedom of choice. And with that choice, then we can go on to be selfish if we choose, or we can go on, you know, to be humanitarian, to take care of our brother. But we do have a choice, and not, are not bound, you know, by the laws that we've conjured.
Wouldn't there be utter chaos over if I did exactly what they please?
No, I'm not necessarily justifying it, but I think that this is, I think that's her point more than, I don't think she's saying, you know, you be selfish, you take care of yourself, you know, but rather, you have the choice to do with your life what you want to.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask a question. What is the difference between selfishness and individuality? Would you define that?
That to me is a very good question. Is if you are an individual, aren't you selfish? Socially. Because you, an individual, is obliged almost. If he thinks what is better, he does it. He doesn't regard society. He doesn't regard what is commonly done. And this is how our progress is made. She cites examples of progress. And this is why there hasn't been progress in this community of theirs, because everyone had to agree on the invention of the candle for 50 years. And, you know, there's standard progress. That is a very good point.
I would say that selfishness is lack of concern for anyone else. And individuality is the uniqueness of an individual person.
And also, individuality can be expressed in selflessness. Sometimes the person can, well, you can recognize that individual by their self-giving or their seeming selflessness, you know. To me, individuality is something separate from selfishness.
There's one thing here, if you can result your opinion from them. I think Dr. Reagan sums it all up when he says, why do we have love? If we all obey the basic commandment of love, you know, love one another as I have loved you, there would be so much generally love and concern for each other, there would be absolutely no need for any type of law. For instance, cutting down the hedges on the corner, we'd be concerned that by our lack of doing this, that it would cause other people to be hurt. The same way driving on the other side of the road, there's a possibility that because of this action, we would be hurting other people. And so if you're genuinely concerned, generally, about everyone as I instructed, there would be no need for these obligations in the law.
It's these individuals, though, that necessitate the laws of
the It's only because we don't follow the law that God's command and Jesus' commandment that the laws are necessary.
It seems as though this isn't exactly radical. It seems as though it's been tried. It's kind of the credo of British imperialism and American and 19th century capitalism and unlimited free enterprise and the only modern. More recent politicians I can think of espousing it are Adolf Hitler and Barry Goldwater, and I think they were fairly well rejected. I just can't see it as too much of a breakthrough.
Well, you're setting, I think, bad examples. there are things like Einstein, there is St. John Peirce, Quasimodo in poetry, Einstein in science, or Max Planck in science and physics, who develop things for which we may not like, the bomb or things like that, but also they have many good points about it as well.
It seems though in the 19th century, though, the entire thrust of this country was every man for himself, as little control as possible, and there's all kinds of goodies out there, and just go get them. But as soon as we started living a little bit closer, stepping on each other's toes, we found this was just terribly destructive of other people's rights and property. And it seems like ever since the turn of the century, we've been trying to find a little bit of corrective. I just wonder if we could go right back to laissez-faire again, but almost anarchy.
How would you say we are now? Are we kind of agree to go along with the rule?
Well, it seems like you've got a vocal minority anytime too many liberties are trying to take away.
How would you say things like power structures, corporations, unions, factions, lobbyists, status quo, status affluence? How about these terms? When these really apply, when GM represents more of the economy than any small business, or when the Rifle Club presents a lot of legislation, and legislation, how do you say on that? Isn't that what's developed? Isn't the union kind of developed right after this independent individual thing? Weren't the unions developed right about that time? And weren't big corporations following the right path?
Seems like right now you pretty much have to pick your master. I mean,
in other words, join the club.
Well, either big government or big business or big labor. But what's the little individual going to do?
Have we approached that point that we are no longer important as ourselves? Oh, sure, we can vote this year for Nixon. We like war. Or if McCarthy's running the other side, if we don't like war, we can vote for him. But we're not even voting directly, it's for the electoral votes, and that's a politician group right there.